Well, I just wanted to say that I don't know how much use I'm going to be as an interviewee because I just went to the every year on the days. So mm-hmm. I didn't actually camp there, but I went to quite a few of the days and did this record. I went there very much, you know, as a supporter there. So yeah, I haven't.
You were a Greenham woman.
I was a Greenham woman, and I thought it was really important to document it as a woman because the only men there were the police mm-hmm. and some photographers. And I thought, well, why can't they have women photographers? And I was doing photography at college at the time, and I thought, well, I'm going to go and document this as a woman.
Very good, absolutely.
So, I mean, all the women there, we're all old doddery things, you know, I'm nearly 70. And all you look at the women there and thinking, blimey, a lot of the women there must be really old now, if not dead.
Yeah, some of them, unfortunately, yeah. Mm. But I think that was what was so brilliant about it. It was such a wide age range from, you know, tiny children, you know, being brought by their parents and families to the camp to, you know, elderly women. It seemed to be a place that welcomed everybody.
Yeah.
Would you agree? Or?
Yeah, yes. I mean, yeah. That was a thing. It was the other thing what I think is really remarkable is that it happened in days before the computers and mobile phones and social media. And, you know, in one of my photographs, it shows the long lines of coaches.
Yes, I saw that, yeah.
It's absolutely staggering to think that how, you know, the message was passed on either in written form or by landlines.
Mm.
You know, when they organised coaches from all these places on that annual day from all over the country, CMD, and it's staggering to see all those coaches and all these women coming and without any sort of computers or mobile phones. You think, how did we do it?
Yeah.
Of course we did.
Yeah, definitely. So were you part of like a phone tree or anything when you weren't at the camp?
I was in Sheffield CND.
Right,
I lived in Sheffield at the time, which was very political, and it was the South, you know, Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire.
Mm.
And it was very active there. And, you know, the 80s were a very feminist time as well. And we were determined to go and support the women there. I had two small children at the time and I did in school. So I didn't really want to go and live there, but I was, you know, really into supporting the group.
Did your children, did you ever take them to the camp?
No, they never came, but they were always, you know, it's funny how feminist and independent my daughter has turned out, how political and left-wing she's turned out, just because of her upbringing and what she saw me doing.
Well, yeah, children learn what they live, don't they? So you were constantly setting that example.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, now there's all the Extinction Rebellion and there's loads and loads of protests. But, you know, there was no violence at Greenham.
No.
Even the photos of mine where you see the police coming in and removing the women, no one was hurt. It was just a peaceful thing where they sat down and were not moving. And the police cleared them without hurting them. And no one threw bottles or bricks or anything like that.
Did you not have any experience then of police brutality or, you know, brutality from soldiers or anything there?
No, not when I was there, no. I don't know other women's experience. Some of the women who lived there might have had different experiences.
Yeah. So when did you first go to Greenham? Can you tell me about that, your first impressions and what brought you there?
So I first went to Greenham, would it have been 83, 84? When was it set up? I can't remember.
Well, 81 was, you know, right at the start of it, yeah.
Okay. So maybe it was 82. as I said, I was living in Sheffield and I was a member of Sheffield C&D.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt really anxious about having nuclear weapons then. I mean, there's all sorts of threats now, like climate change and all sorts of things going on. But then nuclear war was a huge risk.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't want the we didn't want those missiles on our land. And so I went with Sheffield CND, and what struck me was the range when I got there, just how ordinary the women there were. Because on the days I went, there were lots and lots of women, but there were women ranging from young mothers with children to grandmothers, and everybody was really happy. And as I said, there was no violence. And just to see that amount of women in those days without the social media, mobile phones, computers, it was staggering. And it kind of grew over the years on that day until there were quite, you know, so thousands and thousands of women there. But I found it a very friendly, a very kind of happy place among the women. And, you know, it just, the things that people, the women wove flowers on the fence. And what struck me was how awful this wire was and these towers, watchtowers with soldiers with guns in them. And I went to Berlin before the wall came down, and I photographed the wall as well because I thought that was important. And they had similar towers. They had a wall, they didn't have a fence, but they had towers with soldiers in. And it just made me ashamed, really, of being a human being, to think that we've done this, that we've set up these situations where, in this case, it was women against men with guns. And I never saw any violence. I never saw anything that I felt uncomfortable with at the place. And I think it had an effect because it was the first of its kind. It was the first of its kind. And I don't know if there's been any particularly just pure women demonstrations since then.
I think some, but not on that scale, definitely.
It was a huge scale. And it was particular of its time, because it was in the 80s, because feminism was on the rise. Politically, we didn't have other issues to campaign about, like climate change or Extinction Rebellion. And so it did get, it was a big focus. Big focus, because before that there hadn't been anything as big as this that was threatening to our lives.
No. How do you think the media covered it? What was your experience of the media at the time?
I can't really remember, except on a personal detail, you know, that nobody could think that there was a load of women who were actually mothers and grandmothers who were supporting a cause. Because you've got to remember, before that, in the 50s and 60s, women were only finding their place in society.
Yeah.
You know, women couldn't get mortgages in the sort of, you know, until when? I don't know, was it the 60s or 70s in their own name? It was that.
It was that late. Wow.
I know that, you know, people found, I went to university in 69, and in a university setting, I felt an equal to a man, and I've always felt equal to a man. But some people have said that at that time, so you're talking about the late 60s, early 70s, women were very, very, their role in society was very subordinate.
Absolutely.
So I can't remember the press at the time at all, but I can remember some people, you know, saying to me, you know, they felt a bit uncomfortable about it because nobody had protested before like that in such scale.
Fear of the unknown from some people. Yeah.
Well, except for the, I suppose, the Aldermaston, you know, CND before that. But I was a bit young for that. I didn't go on that.
No.
It didn't go on those. But it was during that time, I think in the 80s, and you got the Thatcher era.
Mm.
I then, when I was living in Sheffield, then there was the miners' strike, and I was involved in supporting them, and there was Thatcherism going on, and the whole of society just felt under threat.
Mm. How did you feel about that, the fact that we, as a country, had a female prime minister and the juxtaposition of that with what was going on in the country and her allowing the missiles there? How did that make you feel as a woman?
Terrible.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrible. You know, there was the thinking, yes, we've got a female prime minister, great. But look how terrible she was. I mean, I can't believe the damage she did to the country, the damage she did. And I can tell you, I was teaching in a pit village at the time. I was working in a school, and all the local teaching assistants were local women who were married to miners, and the hardship they had. And they got food parcels in inverted commas that consisted of a bar of soap and a few toilet rolls. And they were extremely worried. And the mother of one of my children came into school one morning, clearly having had a nervous breakdown. And the head said, just leave your class. I'll get someone in there. Take her to, the local hospital, and she'll have to be admitted. Just take her, because she was having a breakdown. And she was. She was taken into the psychiatric hospital, because the stress was too much.
Yeah.
I used to drive past Orgreave and the battles there and the police lining the roads to get the imported coal in, because the pits were closed, and the anger of the miners and, the violence really that went on with the police, with the Met that came up from London to fight the police, to fight the miners.
Yeah.
Was appalling. It was appalling, the injuries that were caused.
And the female prime minister.
And I think that, everything she did as a female prime minister was against so many values that we felt were against what we stood for.
Mm.
Peaceful, we wanted peace. We wanted freedom. We wanted the best for everybody. We wanted a socialist society that looked after everybody.
Yeah.
Instead of every man for himself, which is what she brought in.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid that still reigns today.
Yeah. What do you think people could learn today from Greenham? So you said, you've mentioned Extinction Rebellion and things like that. What lessons can be learned from the women of Greenham?
I think people have got to realise that people power works. Look what it did in the late 80s when people brought down the Berlin Wall. I tell you, that was a travesty. That was a disgrace to the human race, having that up.
Mm-hmm.
The wall came down, countries were liberated, and all of Eastern Europe was changed, and it was pure people power being out on the streets. Mm-hmm. And, the women did have an effect.
Yeah.
I think they did have an effect. If not, just to show people that they could do this. And then, of course, in the 80s, it was the same. The 80s was also the decade that the Eastern Europeans rose up. And there was marches in London, the poll tax. All of those marches happened. And I think it was because Greenham showed the way that we can do this. You can get your feet, you can get your boots on the street, and you can show with your body that you are unhappy. And of course, now you look around the world and it's almost numb to it. I was thinking, oh, yes, there they are on the streets there, and they're protesting against their president, and it's just commonplace.
Yeah.
But the trouble with it now is that it's really violent.
Mm.
So you get these extremes going on, because the thing about Greenham, it was middle of the road. It was just ordinary women. They weren't extreme at all. Yeah.
Speaking on that, what non-violent direct actions did you take part in then? So were you there for Embrace the Base?
I can't remember.
I saw in looking through the photographs, wonderful photographs that you sent me, there was one of the mirrors, so I'm assuming you were there for Reflect the Base.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Yeah. That was good to reflect the base back on itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I can't really remember myself, unfortunately, much about it. But as I said, most of what I was interested in was recording it in visually.
Mm. Well, the photographs you sent me, some of them are so powerful and beautiful. And informative. There's so many. The one of the bender I thought was particularly beautiful, the way the light's kind of hitting, you can see the women inside the bender.
Oh, the polythene.
Yeah, it's a stunning photograph. It's amazing.
I think the photos give a range of what was there. Because obviously there were different groups from various parts of the country.
Mm.
And I printed all my own work. So a lot of it was black and white, because I could go to college, and just go into the dark room and do a lot of it. It was easy. But then I started printing my own colour, which is far more difficult to get the colours right. Of course, now it's all digital and I can't use digital at all. But in those days... So I wanted to do some colour work to show the beautiful rainbows on the banners and to show, the atmosphere, the sort of light and the smoke and the mist. And, I think it was important because there was a lot of beauty there.
Mm.
There was a lot of beauty there. And I hope that some of my photos are beautiful. And I'm really glad that they, some of them, will be seen, because I don't want it lost.
No. There was one of the photos showed, it had an address on it, a number one golf grove.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit about that? Were there different,
I think that was because it was, I think it was just a joke. I think it was near the, was there a golf course nearby?
Yeah, there is a golf course nearby, yeah.
Yeah, so it was like a spiff on, this is number one golf grove. Yeah.
There did seem to be a lot of humour, through the, the pain and the anguish, which is why the women were there. There seems to be a lot of, humour going through it. How important was that, do you think, at the camp?
I think it's really important. Really important. And some of the notice they have, one of my favorite photos is that ribbon that says something like, down with defense. What fence? Defense around
the corner. Yes.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, there's a lot of puns going on, I think, and with women's names as well, when they got arrested, the different names that they'd make up always make me laugh when I hear those.
Yes, well, I'm glad that you got those women, that they were sort of who went for longer than me and, did more than I did. But as I say, I think my contribution mostly are the photographs.
I think the photographs are amazing, but all, the women that we speak to, in fact, especially women who were there long term, very long term, some of them for years and years, are very much of the view that Greenham women are everywhere and they value the people who came once or just at weekends, or, you know, just to big actions. The attitude is all very much all of us are green and women. It doesn't matter if you were there for 10 years or for one day, you contributed to that. And that's the general feeling from all the women that we interview.
Good. Because I was very grateful that women were willing to go and camp there, you know, when they were the backbone of it.
I really think it could happen again today.
I don't know. No, I don't know. I think there's not the same feeling in the world today. There's more despair in the world today. It's almost a sort of giving up thing. In those days, we didn't think the world was going to end in 50 years or society would collapse or there'd be no food growth because of climate change, but we do now. So we actually thought the earth had a future. You know, I think I'm not so sure anymore.
How does your Buddhism link in to all of this and your kind of attitudes in the world? Can you tell me about how you came to Buddhism and how that's shaped your life, I suppose, since Greenham?
Yes. So I was a really angry young woman in the 80s. I was in my 30s. And I could see all the suffering in the world. And I really believed that you could change the world politically. That was the way to do it, was through politics. And I was a bit of a hedonist, as we all were in those times, you know, doing various things. And yes, but I did find, you know, during the 80s, the world changed again to being very, very materialistic. And because I was very much part of the hippie movements in the late 60s and 70s, and really believing in a new age of peace and love, and we could change the world. And I think the Green movement, the DND movement, was part of that. Yes, we can change the world. We don't want it to be a nuclear world. We want disarmament. But gradually I got very disillusioned and I felt that I was still suffering. And so in the late 90s, I remember I was going trekking in Nepal. So I went to a Buddhist centre here before I went to find out a bit more about Buddhism. And as soon as I heard the words of the Buddha, I suddenly thought, that's how I feel. As he said, that suffering exists. And it's the way we deal with it that causes us to be happy or unhappy. And so I thought, yeah, that's true. So I've tried to change the world and haven't succeeded very much. And I felt a bit disillusioned about the way the world was going. So I thought, well, I can change myself, which is what Buddhism teaches you. That suffering, you know, shit happens. And the suffering exists. But through my practice, it's the way I react to everything that makes me suffer or not. Or I can just look to my mental states, accept the way things are, try and act ethically in the world. And of course, ethics is a big part of Buddhism. So actually it all ties in with trying to make a better world. By it's not only how I act personally in my body and speech and mind, my thoughts and actions, but you know, from the clothes I wear, or you know, recycling, or driving, pollution, the whole lot, the sort of global ethics you take on. And I suppose it's a phase of life, isn't it? I was a young woman in the 80s, really for it, up for it, but I found in as I got older, actually, the Buddhist approach, I still feel strongly about issues. But the way I approach it is very different. I'm not so angry. Like I said, I'm much more accepting and I do what I can. But I think that yes, finding Buddhism and changing my, it just changed me completely. So completely that I see, instead of this is wrong and that's wrong and they've got the climate's awful and that's wrong, it suddenly became my life became half full instead of half empty.
Yeah.
And so it makes you see, I could see now the beauty in everything and living in a much deeper, stiller space. Sort of, yes, there's still work to be done in the world, but actually doing it from a much deeper, stiller space.
In quite a few of your photographs, there are children, so there's some little toddlers, and there's one of a couple of women and one woman's holding a tiny baby. Could you just tell me a bit about the experience of children at the camp, and did you have much to do with them, and how did they seem?
Some of the women I went on the coach with, it was quite a long drive as well, you know, we had to set off at 6 a.m. from Sheffield to get to Greenham, and you know, some of the kids would get on the coach in their pyjamas, goes back to sleep again, and you know, have a coat on there. But yeah, I think it was a good experience for them. It was a good experience. The babies were well cared for. They were all wrapped up against the cold. Always seemed to be cold there.
Yeah.
And the children, I think that they must have learnt quite a lot. I know my daughter, as I said, didn't actually go. I had a son and a daughter, but it did rub off on, especially my daughter being, you know, because I was her role model, because I was active politically and went to Greenham Common. I think now she's, you know, she respects that, you know, what I was doing at the time.
And do you think your son grew up with that respect for women as well?
Well, I hope so. Yes, yes, I hope so. Yes, I think so. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it was very political. I can remember my daughter, aged 8, she was playing in her room one day. We used to have tape recorders, you know, you could put a cassette tape in. And she was 8 years old. And she pretended she was a reporter interviewing Margaret Thatcher. And she was saying, tell me, Margaret Thatcher, why have you put all these miners, closed all the mines and put all these miners out of work? And she, well, I would just like to say, and it's brilliant. She was pretending, and it was all stuff that she'd learned at the kitchen table, us ranting about Margaret Thatcher and about, you know, government.
Do any of those recordings still exist?
You know, I've lost that, so it would be great to find that.
It would. I know from because I was born in 1980, so and I remember it. But, you know, I didn't go, but I remember my mum making me aware of it, and it amazes me the amount of people I speak to who've, what, you know, when I say what I'm doing in my work at the moment, I see the blank faces, and then I give them a bit of time and they say, I'm sorry, you're going to have to tell me what Greenham Common is. Have you come across that much? Obviously, your, you know, children have grown up very much knowing about it, but.
Well, I suppose my friends, you know, are a lot of Buddhists, some of my friends, and also, you know, most of them have heard of it. They've all heard of it because of the circles you mix in.
Yeah.
I mean, we're unlikely to sort of mix much with people who weren't politically aware. Let's say, yeah, my friends are politically aware.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there are people, some people are not political.
No.
You have to be political.
The people, most people, they're aware of other things that were going on at the time, and a lot of them are very politically engaged now. And they're aware of the miners' strikes, everyone that I have anything to do with is very aware of the miners' strikes, but not of Greenham. What do you think the difference is? Why do you think Greenham isn't in the public consciousness as much?
Well, one thing could be media coverage, in the fact that lots of films and documentaries have been made about the miners' strike. Pardon me. I mean, not only documentaries, but you've got films like Pride.
Yeah.
Which is a brilliant film.
An amazing film, yeah.
And that's a true story.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's about the miners' strike. You've got the background of things like, was it Billy Elliot? Is that?
Yeah.
See, these are mainstream films that the miners' strike was mentioned in, that covers, and there's loads more of them. And so the people became aware. I can't think of a single mainstream film about Greenham Common, can you? No. It would be really good.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't want the whole thing that so many women, thousands of women, felt, tens of thousands, felt so passionately about, to be lost.
Yeah.
And to be done at the time. I mean, it was a product of its time. And also, as I said, it was done without the social media side of it.
Mm.
And the computers and phones and things. It was incredible how it happened.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share about Greenham? Anything that I've not asked you about?
No, I don't think so. I mean, as I say, I've got my photos, which for me, I'm really pleased I've got those. And it's funny, when I moved down here, I threw so much away. I threw all my photography, the darkroom stuff away. And I was going to get rid of these photos. And my husband said, no, don't. All my work, because I just thought, well, you're not the same person anymore. You know, I'm not a green woman. And yet, I kept them, and I'm really glad that I have kept them, because it's I think it's historical documents.
Yeah, we're very, very glad that you kept them. I think once a Greenham woman, always a Greenham woman.
Yeah, the spirit's still there. Yeah, we're still angry young women at heart, even though we're in our 60s, 70s and 80s.
And still making an impact on the world. Even if it's just a little corner of the world.
Well, I hope so. I try to, through my Buddhist practice, to show by example of acting ethically, standing up for what I think is right.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much, Anne, for speaking to me this morning. I can't thank you enough.
That's okay.
It's been so interesting and wonderful to talk to you.